Hi, everybody. Radio Free Mormon here at the end of the fifth session of the April 2024 General Conference. I have lived to tell the tale. Yes, there is a God. I've got to tell you, it is painful to watch one session of General Conference. It's more painful to watch two, three, and then four, and then five all in the same weekend. This really is inhumane. No church that cares about its members would put its members through this kind of ordeal. I feel like my Eighth Amendment rights have been violated, the rights against cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, it hurts, not just my head. It actually hurts my body. It manifests itself physically, how painful this is and how boring it is and how trumped up it is and how so many people are trying to give so much sanctimonious piety around so little substance. I suppose I'll just put it that way. But having introduced the fifth and final session here and Radio Free Mormon watching General Conference, so you don't have to, we're going to go to our recap. And that is the good news. It's over. That's the best news that we have from General Conference, is that now it is over. Okay. This is going to be Radio Free Mormon episode 336. I'm going to juice up the power so we can get through this. All right. Now in this conference, if you haven't been keeping track, the session, we get to find out who that third apostle is, who's going to be able to preside. Remember, Elder Oaks told us yesterday morning that there would be three conference sessions where apostles get to preside. And we saw two of those. And now we get to the third one. By the way, I wasn't betting on which apostle would be able to preside in this last session, but I did have a bet on the side going as to which apostle would not be able to preside. And my guess and my bet was that of all the apostles, the one who definitely would not be asked by President Nelson to preside over any session would be Elder Uchtdorf. And I was right. It wasn't Elder Uchtdorf. No, it is, let's see here, Elder Cook. Elder Cook gets the prize. He gets to preside. By the way, I also wanted to correct something. I had said in the last podcast that nobody yesterday had mentioned that it was April 6th and that that was the day the church was organized. Apparently, I got that wrong because Elder Gong did mention it. At least I was notified of that by Martine, who let me know by text, hey, he did mention that last night. I tell you, I was watching the whole thing. I didn't snooze off. I was tempted. I almost did. The head was nodding. Elder Gong is so boring. But still, I can't believe I missed it. But there you have it. Apparently, it was mentioned by somebody yesterday. Also, the question on everybody's mind at the commencement of this session is, will President Nelson address the congregation? He has not addressed the congregation at all up to this point in this conference. And usually he's all over the place. Usually you can't shut the guy up. He's talking in virtually every session. He has not spoken in any session. And indeed, I believe the only session that he was present for was yesterday afternoon's session. Okay. So that's the question. Will he show up in this final session? Even though nobody said he will he be there? Will he be there? That's the tension that's gripping the audience in the conference center. And if he does show up to make an address, will it be live or will it be Memorex? Will he show up in the actual conference center or will he, like last time, last general conference, will there be a pre-recorded talk by President Nelson? So we'll get to find out the answers to those burning questions by the time we get to the end of this session. Okay, Elder Cook is presiding. The choir sings, Come Rejoice. And I want you to know that when the choir sings, I am always scouring the choir to see if I can see my good friend Jim Bennett in the choir. Now, I know he's not over in the women's section of the choir, at least not usually. And he's in the men's section, but he's also in the very back row, partly because of his height. He's a very tall guy. So he stands back there with the other tall guys. I'm sure it has to do also with how he sings. But he's back there. And the problem is that the camera very rarely goes all the way to the back row and shows the people there, just because apparently of the way they're placed and the way that they pan across the faces of the people in the choir. Very rare to see him, but I did see him. I did see him. It's when the camera was way down here in front looking at the organ, and you could see rows and rows and rows of people. And way in the back there, tiny face, but I recognized it as Jim Bennett. So hi, Jim. Shout out to you. An invocation then was given by an elder from the 70, and D. Todd Christofferson is the first speaker. All right. D. Todd Christofferson. He talks about the vision of glory, i.e. section 76 that Joseph Smith has with Sidney Rigdon back on February 16th, 1832. And they see the people who inherit the celestial kingdom, the terrestrial kingdom, and the telestial kingdom. And he wants to go through the qualifications of each of the people who inherit each of those kingdoms, which he does. He arrives at the conclusion that the distinguishing characteristic between each of these groups is how they relate to the testimony of Jesus, whatever that is. It's not described in the Revelation. He says that those who are in the celestial kingdom have wholehearted devotion for this testimony of Jesus. The ones in the terrestrial kingdom, they receive it, but they're not valiant in it, whatever that means. And then the ones in the telestial kingdom, they just reject it outright, that testimony of Jesus, whatever it is. So he starts with what I think is an interesting question. What is this testimony of Jesus that means so much, how we react to it, that's going to determine our eternal living quarters? And, you know, I'm just not I think the question is much better than his answer, because his answer is basically going to be, you know, fundamental Mormonism, and we have to be obedient, do everything we're supposed to do in order to go to the celestial kingdom, which is kind of going to end up meaning that that's what being valiant in our testimony of Jesus is doing everything we're supposed to do as Mormons. Couldn't see that one coming. He says it is the testimony of scriptures and the prophets that it is only through Jesus that we can be saved. That's the testimony of Jesus. And that he's also the only begotten of the Father, and also that he's our Savior. So the testimony of Jesus, he takes it rather literally here. Beyond this testimony, he says, is the question, well, once we've identified what the testimony is, which I don't think he really has done, of course, he only has 15 minutes to talk, but I'm not sure he could do better in an hour. What do we do about it? What do we do about this testimony of Jesus? Well, if you're in the celestial kingdom, you have to be baptized, you have to follow Jesus, you have to do everything you're supposed to do as a good Mormon. In the terrestrial, you know, some received it, but were not valiant in the testimony of Jesus Christ. They were kind of lukewarm in that testimony. So you can be a member of the church and not be valiant in your testimony of Jesus, not do everything that you're supposed to do and are told to do by the prophets and apostles. And if you don't do that, then maybe you'll just go to the terrestrial kingdom. But the telestial kingdom is those who reject the testimony of Jesus and his prophets. So I guess that's sort of just something of a degree there. I mean, how much is not being valiant, being lukewarm in that testimony, and how much is just rejecting it entirely? I don't know. We'll see. We know it's not becoming a son of perdition, because that's in outer darkness, not the celestial kingdom. He asks, what does it mean to be valiant in the testimony of Jesus? And it's nurturing and strengthening that testimony. True disciples don't ignore the small things, such as prayer, scripture, Sabbath day observance, taking the sacrament worthy, repenting of our sins, ministering, which is a new word for home teaching, and going to the temple. In other words, doing all the ABCs up through Z and beyond of being a Mormon and doing them right and doing them often. Now, he quotes President Nelson. Honestly, this is amazing. If you could find one talk that doesn't quote President Nelson, I want to give that speaker a prize. He quotes him to the effect of how quickly a testimony can crumble if we don't do all the things we're supposed to do. Also includes being open and public in sharing our testimony. Yes, that missionary work thing. We have to be open and public and share our testimony with everybody else. And we have to heed God's messages, which come conveniently through the prophets of the Mormon Church, of course. He includes encouraging others to do the same things that we're supposed to do as being valiant in the testimony of Jesus. So not only do we follow the LDS prophet, we encourage others to follow the LDS prophet too. And that's part of our being valiant in our testimonies, helping other people be valiant in their testimony. Then he says something kind of unfortunate where he talks about parents. And of course, he has to give the common guilting trope for parents that if you're not sufficiently valiant in your testimony, if you're lax if you're slack in your testimony of Jesus Christ and not doing everything you're supposed to do, well, that could impact your kids. And they might not be as valiant too. And then their kids might be hostile to the church. And so it goes. And he quotes Neil A. Maxwell to this effect to make this point. So the pressure is really on the parents in the Mormon church. And if your kids go out of the way, stop attending church, maybe think they should go somewhere else, or maybe the church isn't the place for them, it's kind of your fault. It's all on you, parents. He tells a story about John Groberg. It's actually a story that John Groberg told. And of course, it has to do with the South Pacific. It's a family in Hawaii. Oh, I really, really, I don't like this story. I don't like this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. A family in Hawaii, it's in the early 1900s, so it's probably about 100 years ago, maybe more. Daughter, they're in the church, though. Their daughter falls ill with an unknown disease and got hospitalized. So they're going to church, though. Their daughter's in the hospital, but they're going to church. And this father, this young father, goes to church. He kneels to bless the bread as part of the sacrament at church. And the branch president says, "Stop. I didn't realize who you were. You're the one with the daughter who's in the hospital with the unknown disease. You can't bless the sacrament. We can't have you here. Go." And you know, I don't know if it happened that dramatically. Maybe it did. Or that abruptly, maybe it did. But I can kind of see where the branch president is coming from. If you've been in contact with somebody with an unknown disease, we don't want you around people who don't have the disease, because that's how people can get the disease. We don't know how it can be contracted. So you need to leave. And he does. He takes his family. They leave. And then the story segues to what happens when they get home. So this father takes his family, they go home, they sit in a circle, he tells them to be quiet and don't say anything until he's ready to speak. And maybe that's because he was so upset. His son wonders what his father is going to do to revenge for their embarrassment and mistreatment by the branch president. Would they go kill the branch president? Would they go burn his house down? Is this what his father will come up with when he starts talking? Well, after 15 minutes, the father opens his eyes and tells all of them that he loves them individually, and he wants them all to be together forever as a family. And the only way to be faithful, yeah, you know where this is going. The only way to be faithful and be sealed in the temple, excuse me, the only way to live forever as a family is to be faithful in the LDS church and be sealed in the temple. And then he tells them it is not the branch president's church. This is Jesus's church. And we will not allow the branch president's pride to keep us out of God's church. So obviously this story is told as a talk about not being offended. You members of the church who got offended by some other member, don't allow it to lead you out of the church. Don't allow it to impact your faithfulness and your observance of Mormonism. It's obviously a talk about not being offended by members of the church, no matter how badly you are treated by the leaders of the church. I've got to tell you, I hate these kinds of stories. I understand what they're getting at, right? Yeah, you shouldn't leave a church because somebody over here is not perfect, because it's Jesus's church. I get the theory. Unfortunately, what these stories end up teaching, and they are told with some regularity in the LDS church, I hate these kinds of stories because they teach members to endure unending abuse from church leaders. And regardless of how bad this abuse is, the member must still remain faithful, still continue going to church, still continue doing all the things that they're supposed to do as a Mormon, regardless of how bad they may be treated by members or even by leaders. And no matter how badly those leaders act, SEC, regardless of how bad the leaders act, you must stay in the church doing all the things you were supposed to do. Yeah, I think that's a veiled reference to members being upset with the leaders for breaking the law in order to hide how much money they had and getting fined for it. So whatever truth there may be in these kinds of stories, I can't overlook the fact that they also serve as a justification for the worst possible kinds of behaviors by church leaders, from the branch presidents all the way up to the prophet. Elder D. Todd says we need to act now. D. Todd Christofferson, that is. He says we need to act now because you don't know when you will die and your soul will not be saved unless you get your act in order, Mormon-wise, before you die. That was a little bit arm-twisting of him. Now, the second talk is Elder Taylor Godoy of the 70. He talks about a sign that he saw in the hospital. This is a real sign, not a sign from God, although he's going to sort of make it a sign from God as he elaborates upon it in his talk. He's in the hospital. He sees a sign in his room, and the sign says, "Call. Don't fall." This was hard to understand for a while, and it took me about halfway through the talk before I realized that's exactly what the sign said. Call, don't fall. So give a call, ask for help, like getting out of bed or maybe getting off the john if you're using the restroom, and do that rather than falling. I get it. Call, don't fall. This is what will be the theme of his talk. And once again, this becomes another talk about bad things happening to people, even faithful people, and how to endure them. You know, when you start paying attention to what is said in General Conference and really making notes and analyzing it like I've been doing, I start to realize that the same talk is given in General Conference, not just every General Conference, you get the same talk, but you get the same talk repeatedly, even within the same General Conference. Is this the third kind of talk, or is it the fourth kind of this talk that we've had in General Conference so far? I know it's not the first. So, of course, the call part on the sign, he's going to analogize to praying to God. Call, pray to God, so that you, what? Don't fall, right? So this is the call part of the sign. We need to pray to God so that we don't fall. Got it. Okay. I got the message. Not bad. But he's got 10 minutes to fill up, so he's going to have to elaborate on it. And goes through the examples from scriptures like Helaman and his army praying to God so they don't fall. Moses praying to God. Abraham praying to God. When preparing for his marriage, now he tells this story. And it's a relatively interesting story. I had a little bit of trouble following it, and maybe it's because it had to do with the legal requirements for marriage in a different country, which I'm guessing was somewhere maybe in South America, possibly Central America. He's talking about that he's getting ready to get married, and in this country, wherever it is, he has to get married to his wife civilly, I believe, before they can get married in the temple. And I'm not sure he said that, but that would make sense. It would make the whole story hold together better if he had. Once again, English is not his first language. I'm not trying to fault him. I'm just saying that sometimes I can't follow it as well, but I try. Remember, there was a number of years ago when they actually did this experiment of allowing people to speak in General Conference in their native tongue. Everybody did it except for Elder Uchtdorf, right? And then they put up the words underneath where they were talking, right? They had the subtitles, I think that's what it's called, subtitles, and you could read it, but they were speaking in their own language. And that was interesting. They only did it once, but now they force everybody, regardless of what their language of origin is, to speak in English. And sometimes it's not too easy for me to understand. So they're going to get married, but they get a call that all civil marriages in this country have been canceled due to a strike. So there's some kind of government strike that's going on, and the people who do the civil marriages can't do them, or the people who process the documents necessary for the civil marriages can't do them. So they're in a jam because they've got a date at the temple to get married. Oh, it was Lima, Peru. I believe it was Lima, he said, was where they got married. Doesn't mean that they were in Peru, but probably they were. All right, having said all that, this was 3 days before he set to get married. He and his fiance called And when they found out that civil marriages were ended, so they called. They prayed to God about it, right? And then somebody told them about a small place on the outskirts of the city where they lived where a person could marry them. And they called this guy, and he says, yeah, he would marry them, but they had to get the documents first. So now they got to get the documents to get married by this guy who will agree to marry him. So the next day, he said they moved to the small town. And I don't know if that means actually moving their residence. It sounded that way. Or if they just went there. But I'm pretty sure he said they moved to the small town where this guy lived who would marry them. And then they went to get the documents, but they were refused because so many young couples were moving to that town to get married without their parents' permission. Okay, well, now we can't get the documents, dang it. He is inspired now to give this civic authority, whoever it is he's talking to, his temple recommend. And he doesn't know why, but the official looks at the temple recommend and he goes, oh, why didn't you tell me you were members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? That's a horse of a different color. And he says, oh, I know you guys well. You're wonderful people. I will prepare the documents. So the presence of the temple recommend greases the skids for this official, and he's going to prepare the documents. They need to get married. Now he disappears, doesn't come back for a while. They're looking at their watches. It's getting later. They need the documents. And finally he comes back, and he comes back with a poppy, which he gives them along with the documents. So they're very happy. They head to get married. And then, and once again, I'm not sure if I've got this exactly right. I tried to listen as closely as I could, and I apologize. I do try and get these as accurately as I can. But it sounds like he says that the same person who had just given them the documents along with the poppy intercepts them and said he was sorry that he shouldn't have given them the documents because he wasn't supposed to. But they have a dog with them, and he says, so, oh, that's a nice doggy you have. Why do you have such a nice doggy? And they say, well, we're going to give this doggy to you. And this official was delighted, and he gave them back the documents that he had confiscated from them, and they got married. Yay. That was a complicated story. So I think it's definitely a story about persistence and overcoming obstacles. And I think it's a great story. But of course, all glory must be to God. So the first thing you have to do is pray to God. Anytime you got any kind of trouble, call God, phone home, pray to God, and he will help you. Do all you can, though, to make it happen. Whatever it is that you need to have happen that you're praying to God for help, do everything you can to make it happen. Then be humble and wait for God to answer your prayer in his own time and in his own way, which means it may not be answered at all. Okay, which leads us to these two rules, which I wrote down. No, is it three? We'll see how many it is. Number one, if we do everything we can do to make our prayers come to pass, and it does come to pass, we give the credit to God and not to ourselves for doing everything that we could do. And number two, if we do everything we can to make our prayers come to pass, and it does not come to pass, we give the credit to God for answering our prayer in his own time and in his own way. It's heads, God wins, and tails, God wins. I'm sorry. Heads, God wins, tails, God wins. No matter what happens, God's answering your prayer. There is nothing, literally, there is nothing that can happen in response to a prayer that God doesn't get the credit for, even if nothing happens. It's like Mel Brooks says in The History of the World, Part 2, it's good to be the king. Okay, now the choir sings softly and tenderly, and the third speaker is Elder Gary Stevenson. Okay, here's what Gary Stevenson's going to do. First off, he's going to talk about suspension bridges, and it's an unfortunate time for him to have come up with a rather elaborate description of his fascination and love of suspension bridges and how they work, given what happened in Baltimore a week or two ago, when that tanker runs into the suspension bridge there in Baltimore, and like almost the entire thing collapses into the water. So he'd already been working on his talk. Apparently that happens. He doesn't want to revise his talk, but he does at least acknowledge the fact that 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 had happened, and extending thoughts and prayers to the people who lost their lives in that. All right. He wants to talk about how amazing suspension bridges are. This is going to be another strained metaphor, likening suspension bridges to how it is we have to do everything we're supposed to do as Mormons. That's what I wrote at the beginning, and I'm pretty close to being right on. He says the power of the tower is the magic in supporting the suspended roadway between. And of course, after he goes through all these descriptions of how it's built and how it works, he's going to look at it through a gospel lens. Basically, you've got two towers, and those two towers have to be really, really solid. And from those towers are suspended the bridge that runs in between, just like the Golden Gate Bridge. And that's one of the bridges that he shows as an example. So what he's going to do is liken these two big towers in a suspension bridge that hold everything up to the two great commandments. Yes, love God with all your heart, might, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And once again, he's going to bastardize that saying of Jesus to try and say that you have to balance those two commandments, right? That we show our love for God by paying our tithing, by obeying his commandments and all of these things. That's how we show our love for God. That's wrong. Within the context of that saying, we show our love for God by how we treat our neighbors. But he wants to divide it up and say, we show our love for God by doing this, and we show our love for our neighbors by being good to them and kind to them and all this stuff. It's just we can't be too kind to our neighbors or too accepting to our neighbors or too inclusive of our neighbors, because if we do, then we're going to be violating the first commandment that God gave us to not be Christ-like to certain people. See, it doesn't make any sense, but within Mormonism, it's something that has to be made as a distinction. And we've seen this before in another talk in this conference. Okay, let me get back to my notes. Love the Lord with all your heart. This is tower number one, soul and mind. Love for God is not limited or finite. It is infinite and eternal. This can feel abstract or daunting, but it becomes more graspable, he says. If you love me, keep my commandments. Oh, I'm sorry. It becomes more graspable if you understand it as being, if you love me, keep my commandments, okay? Because I know how to keep the commandments, and that's doing all the things that you're supposed to do as a good Mormon. Now, when Jesus says that in the New Testament, if you love me, keep my commandments, it's really unlikely that he's talking about the commandments of Mormonism, but that's a minor point. So he says, I can do this. I can keep the commandments, going to the temple, paying tithes, building people up rather than tearing them down. That's a good idea, very good idea, and showing reverence for sacred things. Okay, and then he talks about there's an experience here. I think it's from when he was a kid and with his friend Vance, and they're going around collecting fast offerings. And he knocks on the door of a humble house, and inside is a German widow who can't even really get up to come to the door, so she calls loudly to them to come in. They're greeted by lots of questions. And they said they had come to accept her fast offering. She said she put a dime on the counter that morning for that purpose. And would you young men be kind enough to put that dime in the envelope and fill out the fast offering slip for me, which of course they agreed to do. Now, I guess we had to get a story in here about a person on a meager income, in this case, a widow, giving her dime for her fast offering to the church. It's like the Mormon version of the widow's mite. The idea, of course, being that if a person who is that poor will pay their fast offering, then what excuse does anyone else have to not pay their fast offering and their tithing as well? So now he comes to that second tower, the second commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself. And he says, love of the Lord is not complete if we neglect our neighbors. See, I really think he's got this wrong. I'm not saying I got the answers, but I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, okay? Even the Book of Mormon supports me, remember? He says, love of the Lord is not complete if we neglect our neighbors. See, I don't think so. I think we show our love for God by how we treat our neighbors. It's not a balancing act. The first commandment is fulfilled in the keeping of the second commandment. we can do nothing for God. I mean, there's lots of scriptures about that. What does he need us for? What does God need a starship for? What does he need a dime for? What does he need $150 billion for, right? We can do nothing for God, but we can help our neighbor. And that is what God commands us to do in order to show our love for him. Elder Oaks started out this abuse of this New Testament story, the one about the two commandments. And I mentioned this yesterday, and I was reminded by someone else who called me on the phone that actually Elder Oaks, a number of years ago, had mentioned this in general conference and, in my opinion, abused the story of the two commandments in exactly the same way that Gary Stevenson is doing it now. I was reminded by someone that subsequent to that, Elder Oaks had apparently issued a modification or a correction that was more in line with what the scripture said, but he doesn't issue it in general conference. No, he gives the talk in general conference, which is the wrong talk, and then he issues some kind of a statement in the church news, is what I was told. And I sort of remembered that having happened. The problem is that when you issue something in general conference and you correct it in the church news, nobody notices. And there was a speaker yesterday who went along with exactly Elder Oaks' first interpretation of the two commandments story. And now we have Gary Stevenson going along with Elder Oaks' first interpretation of the two commandments story and even giving this involved analogy about suspension bridges to support it. He even quotes Elder Oaks in his talk to that effect. Okay. And in between the speaker from yesterday, who was talking about these two commandments that way, and Elder Stevenson today, who's talking about those two commandments that way, the wrong way, I believe, we have, thank God, Elder Uchtdorf last night at the end of the Saturday evening session, challenging that interpretation by both of them and just quoting the Book of Mormon. If you are in the service of your fellow beings, you are only in the service of your God. We can't serve God directly. He orders us or commands us to serve our fellow beings. And that is how we serve God. So I'm going to say this, okay? I'm going to skip a couple of notes because I don't think they're that important. The thing is that within the analogy, you have to build both of these towers and then you suspend the bridge, then you suspend the bridge underneath it, and they are suspended by the strength of the towers. You have to build those towers separately. This is the problem with analogies, because analogies can and often are helpful to our understanding of more abstract things, but at some point, every analogy will break down. And this is the point where the analogy breaks down in comparing the suspension bridge towers to these two commandments. Both towers are necessary to have the suspension bridge work properly. Both towers must function together in complete harmony, and our ability to follow Jesus, he says, is dependent on our ability to follow both commandments with balance to both. You see, some are so focused, he says, on keeping the commandments that they see little value in those who don't keep the commandments, and alternatively, some are so focused on loving others that they lose sight of the fact that we are accountable to God. It's that second lesson that he derives from it that I think is contrary to what Jesus was saying. He says, alternatively, and I think this is the reason he says it and the main point he wants to make, some are so focused on loving others that they lose sight of the fact we are accountable to God, or in other words, we have to love God. Totally backwards. If we're focused on loving God, others, we're doing what God wants us to do, and we're showing our love to God. And this is where the analogy breaks down with the two towers. In the New Testament saying about the two commandments, we build the one bridge carefully, all right? And that's the only bridge we can build, the bridge of the tower, of helping our neighbor and being good to our neighbor and loving our neighbor. That's how we build the one bridge. I said bridge, I'm sorry, the one tower for the suspension bridge. We build the other bridge at the same time. Okay, now understand this is where the analogy breaks down. I hope I'm not getting too abstract here for myself. But we've got two towers, right, for the real bridge, you got to build this tower, you got to build this tower, then you hang the bridge by the suspension ropes, right? If you take that same analogy and apply it to the New Testament teaching, we can't build the first bridge. That's the one about loving God, serving God. We can't do anything to build that bridge. We only have the power to build the second bridge, which is loving our neighbor. And if we were to use that analogy, we would come up with a strange but correct conclusion that by building the second tower, we also build the first tower. We build that first tower and magically, without our working on it, this first tower now comes into being, and then we can hang things on it. I think that is what you would have to go to in order to make this saying match the analogy. But as I say, I believe it breaks down before that point, and that's why I think it breaks down. So ultimately, this talk becomes an extended metaphor to excuse violating the second commandment. I'm going to say that again. First commandment is love God. Second commandment is love your neighbor. And this talk becomes an extended metaphor to excuse violating the second commandment, which is not what Jesus was talking about in the first place. Okay, let's go on. Talk number four. Matthias Held, of the 70. He sounds German. I think he has a German accent, but it's not the booming Beethoven Seventh Symphony voice of Elder Uchtdorf. He talks like a Mormon. He talks like a Mormon with the same general authority voice, but with a German accent. This guy does, Matthias Held. And then it hits me. Elder Uchtdorf doesn't talk like a Mormon. And I think that's why he's such a delightful change of pace to listen to. He doesn't do the GA voice. He does his own voice. And the fact is German just makes it that much more delightful. But this guy, Matthias Held, he talks like a Mormon. A German Mormon, but a Mormon nonetheless. And he tells a story of missing a turn while driving, and he likens it to making wrong decisions in life and bearing the consequences until we can get turned around again. He's going to talk about agency, the fact that we can choose whether we will follow God's commandments. We can choose to have faith to recognize that miracles happen, even when they don't. We can choose to have faith in God rather than fear that he won't be there for us, even when he's not there for us. I'm adding those little parts at the end. He didn't actually say that. Some things are outside our control, and hence they're outside of our agency, right? Such as illness or war or labor or rest. Those are the examples he gave, I believe. But we are still free to choose how we react to them, with a positive attitude or a pessimistic attitude. We can ask for God's support or think we are on our own. He gives examples. We can wear warm clothes in winter or take care of ourselves when we are sick. In other words, we can't choose the circumstances sometimes, but we can choose how we react to them. We correct our wrong choices when we repent. This is how growth happens. Then he talks about how there's opposition in all things, citing 2 Nephi chapter 2. Opposites don't exist apart from each other. They can even complement each other. He tells us, we would not know joy except for sorrow. We could not identify truth unless we had also seen lies, he says. Then he gives a personal experience about his children and just saying children have brought him the greatest joy in his life, but they've also given him the greatest suffering in life. And he talks about the suffering as being worried for them when they get sick or something like that. He says, even during wars, many little acts of love are happening. We need to remember that every experience is like a coin that has a flip side, even if we don't see that flip side at the time. Every experience has that coin. It's like a yin and yang kind of argument. But if we choose to think celestial, yep, he quotes President Nelson, choose to think celestial as President Nelson taught us, then we will overcome all. And I'm wondering, are they selling t-shirts in a kiosk in the lobby of the conference center by this point? The t-shirts that say think celestial on them? The choir sings How Firm a Foundation. And Elder Cook announces the following two speakers. But we know there must be a third speaker. We're an hour left. Two speakers won't fill the whole hour. There must be another speaker. Who could it be? Will it be President Nelson? Could it be President Nelson? The suspense is killing me. Elder Neil Anderson speaks again. not again. Now Elder Anderson speaks. Okay. He talks about all the temples being built. We've got to talk again about all the temples. How many times have we heard about the temples? Across the world, he says, there's a growing feeling drawing us to the house of the Lord. He talks about a 95-year-old friend of his who a year ago had been, okay, this friend of his is 95 years old. She's been taught by the missionaries for 72 years. She hasn't joined the church. And then one day, a year ago, her daughter says to her, or her granddaughter says, hey, I'm going to the temple probably to get married. And she says, the older 95-year-old woman says, I'd like to go to the temple with you. And the daughter says, well, you can't because you haven't been baptized. And the 95-year-old friend says, well, I want to get baptized then. So she takes the missionary discussions, obviously, gets baptized. She's a member of the church. And this was a year ago, so he can announce that a month ago, this woman received her own endowment. Yay. The work of God is going forth. He says, have you wondered why the Lord would direct his prophet at this specific time to dot all the world with his temples? And he asks, have you wondered why it is that God would choose at this specific time to give the church the prosperity necessary to build the temples? Oh, yeah. He's going there. He's going there. Whoa. He is giving an apologetic for why the church has so much money in its freaking EPA account, over $150 billion. And he is saying the reason why is so that we can build all these temples now. Okay, that's a lie. And I say that because of this. All the temples that the church is building, all the money that that takes is chicken feed compared to this huge $150+ billion it has in the Ensign Peak account. The Ensign Peak account has never been accessed for any money to build temples. Why? Because the church has enough money coming in on an annual basis from the tithes of its members to not only cover all church expenses, but they've got $1 billion to $2 billion left over, out of which they fund the temples. And then the rest goes into the EPA account. They don't have to touch the EPA account in order to build temples. So to the extent that Elder Anderson is trying to imply that the prosperity of the church has been delayed until now by God so that we can build all these temples is, I think, misleading at best and deceitful at worst. Elder Anderson talks about members falling away from the church. And then he says, at least for now. He says, everybody or most people or a lot of you may know somebody who's fallen away from the church. And my counsel, he says to you, is don't despair about your friends leaving the church, for with God, nothing is impossible. Now, what he does is he's phrasing the falling away of members of the church in increasing numbers as a fulfillment of a Book of Mormon prophecy, I think it's First Nephi, about there being a commotion in the world in the last days. And that might be chapter 14. Don't quote me on that, but I think it might be. But that prophecy is in there that there'll be a commotion in the world in the last days. People will be in commotion. And he's saying that all the people leaving the church are a fulfillment of that prophecy. Why is God, he asked, bringing the hundreds of his temples closer to us? Because amidst those commotions and temptations prophesied in the Book of Mormon, he has promised to bless his saints. And he is keeping his promise, he says. Now, I did note that it's strange. We are not anymore, apparently, getting the traditional church's true argument because the membership is growing. It is becoming the church's true because the number of temples is growing. So we're switching from membership to temples. Membership, you actually have to convince somebody. Temples, you just have to have the money to build it. And I say, because temples are a function of money, but membership is a function of belief. So even as more and more members are ceasing to believe in the claims of the LDS Church, the LDS Church is nevertheless building more and more temples. That is inexorably the conclusion that has to be drawn from what it is that Elder Anderson is saying. Even as membership is going down, temples are going up. Something doesn't pencil there. He mentions, I got to tell you, I enjoyed last night. Most of this is boring, but Elder Anderson managed to piss me off. Mm-hmm. And good. He's kind of a snake. And here's what I mean. He talks about the Heber City Temple. Over at Mormonish, they have been talking about the Heber City Temple and talking about the community in Heber City that doesn't want the temple there, doesn't want to hear at this location. The church always seems to want to pick locations that are in a residential community where they're going to violate the zoning ordinances unless the church gets them changed, right? They're going to violate the zoning ordinances. They're going to have these massive temple spires are going to be lit up all night long, and people just want to live in peace, okay? Believe it or not, to a non-Mormon, that's not something that's appealing. So, but he starts talking about it by saying the Heber City, there was a meeting or an assemblage of youth, because he's talking about how great the youth are in the church now. And he says 300 youth filled the adjoining park of this Heber City, Utah city meeting. 300 youth filled the adjoining park to show their support for the temple. This is where they're trying to lobby to get the city council to go along with what it is the church wants to do, in spite of the other citizens there who are lobbying against it. He doesn't mention the ones who are lobbying against it. Don't know why. He says that one of the young men said, in addressing the city council about this issue, public comment, he goes in there and tells them he hopes to be married in this temple. Because, you know, he couldn't just go down the road and get married in another temple. It's Utah, for crying out loud. It's getting so, at least in Utah, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a new temple of God. So he wants to be married in this temple, damn it, not the one down the road. And I say, this is why Elder Anderson is bringing this up. Because he knows there's a lot of controversy and pushback against this particular temple by many in the Heber City community. He cannot not know that, which is why the 300 youth were bused to the adjoining park in the first place. You thought that was their idea? We'll just go over to this park and show our support. No, the adults are using the kids to try and show support and get the temple pushed through. And that's also why youth were speaking to the city council members, because the grownups had them do it. Let's see. He tells a story, which is, I don't know. I can talk about it. Let me see what my time is here. I guess it is the last session. We're almost at 50 minutes. He tells a story that's, he calls it a miracle, I believe. It's 1984. And it's just so, it's just a coincidence. Basically, he's in the temple one day and he's doing initiatory work. And he ends up, it's the end of the day, he's almost ready to go home, and somebody comes running up to him and asks, would you do the initiatory work for this one person? He says, sure. It's an unusual name. It's Eliezer Searcy, I think is the name. So he does that, goes home, comes back to the temple the next day. He's doing endowments. And guess what? He's given this guy's name, Eliezer Searcy. That's a coincidence. Then later, that same day, if I'm understanding his story correctly, back in 1984, he was asked, Elder Anderson was asked to assist in a sealing for the dead, which he said, okay, I'll do it. And he heard once again the same name, Eliezer Searcy. He represents Eliezer Searcy in his initiatory, and then the next day in the endowment, and later in the next day in getting sealed. What he lets us know is that the daughter of Eliezer Searcy was present in the temple, and that she's not married, so she can't have a husband. She doesn't have a guy to stand in or to be receive the Washington anointings or the initiatories, or to do the endowment, or to stand in for him being the husband in the sealing ritual. So this is the daughter of Eliezer Searcy. We know his daughter was there at the temple to do her father's work. Initiatories were done one day at the end, so his endowment could be done the next day, right? She's the one who's pushing it through. And the sealing after the endowment. The daughter was not married, so she couldn't use her husband to do the endowment and sealing or initiatory, and Elder Anderson ends up being tapped each time. It is a nice coincidence indeed, but not so extraordinary that we would feel compelled to ascribe it to supernatural power. Guess what Elder Anderson quotes President Nelson? It's true. About all the incredible miracles we will see in the upcoming days. Remember that quote from President Nelson from a few conferences ago where he promised us that in the coming days, he said, we're going to see miracles like we've never seen before. It's going to be amazing. And the hand of God's power, or the power of God's hand, will be manifest. It's going to be incredible. There's going to be a seismic shift in the number of miracles that are happening in the coming days, according to President Nelson. And now, guess what Elder Anderson does? He is going to say that that promise by President Nelson is fulfilled by all the temples being built. Well, that's convenient. Okay, now we're to the point where he gets me mad. I didn't see this coming. He asks the members of the church to pray for the temples that are being built. Pray, he says, that the properties can be purchased, and pray that the city councils will approve the plans for the temples. I went, OMG, exclamation point. You don't need prayer, and you know it. You are literally paying off city officials to get them to approve your temples. Allegedly. If you want to go to Mormonish and look at what they have uncovered about the Lone Star, not Lone Mountain Temple in Nevada, Las Vegas, Nevada, the Lone Mountain Temple. I did a brief story on it on last Monday's Mormon newscast. You go back and watch that. It is incredible what's going on. There is graft going on, allegedly, from the church to city council members in order to get them to pass laws and zoning ordinances to allow the church to build their temples, which are sited and planned in locations that are residential and where they do not fit the zoning ordinances. So they have to have the city councils change the zoning ordinances so they can build their temple where nobody in the neighborhood wants a temple there. It's an amazing thing what the church does. But that's why I say you don't need the prayers of the saints to allow you to purchase the properties. You use the money of the saints to purchase the properties. And you don't need their prayers to have the city council approve plans because you already have money to apparently and allegedly persuade them to do what it is you want them to do in order that you can build your temples wherever you want to. And regardless of what the people around you think or how it is they think about the Mormon church for coming in and bullying them into having their temple built there. And by the way, if the people don't want the temple in their neighborhood, and if you can't pay off the city council, then the church threatens to sue the cities into bankruptcy to get their way. That's what's going on in Cody, Wyoming, is my understanding. Allegedly, okay? This is the part that really bothers me. I don't like the way the church is operating in building its temples. It's the least Christ-like thing one could imagine to build the most Christ-like building or buildings in the world. And to have Elder Anderson now come in here and say, oh, pray that properties can be purchased and pray that city councils and towns will approve the plans. Uh-uh. All right. So Elder Mark L. Pace is going to speak next. He's the Sunday School General President. And frankly, he's just going to talk about reading the Book of Mormon, you know, and following the Come Follow Me manual, reading the Book of Mormon, how important that is, all the things we can learn from it and how we can get closer to God. He gives a couple of, I think, really relatively unimpressive things that he's learned from reading the Book of Mormon. They're kind of obvious and very basic. I'm not going to bore you with those. If you want to be bored by them, read the talk, or you can listen to it on the church website. So this talk is really about reading the Book of Mormon on a daily basis, I conclude. And as we do so, and follow the living prophet, there will be no apostasy in our personal lives. Reading the Book of Mormon isn't enough. We got to follow the living prophet. And frankly, we don't even need to read the Book of Mormon. If we just follow the living prophet, there will be no apostasy in our personal lives. That is the one rule in Mormonism, the one commandment that cannot be broken. We have to follow the living prophet. Everything else is negotiable. Okay, and he's done. And now we've got 30 minutes left. And everybody in the audience is whispering to their neighbor, who's going to be next? There's time for one more speaker. Will it be President Nelson? Could it be President Nelson? Elder Cook starts to speak again, and he's being coy because first he wants to thank everybody who has spoken and everybody who's provided music. And then he lets the cat out of the bag. Finally, the concluding speaker will be our beloved prophet, Russell M. Nelson. Of course, what a fashionable entrance. I knew it. I knew it was going to be President Nelson, and I knew he was going to want to draw it out and increase the suspense, and get people really, really wondering if he was going to show up, and he does. All right. He doesn't show up in conference. Excuse me here for a second. He does not show up in conference. This is pre-recorded, like President Eyring's was. So it's pre-recorded. He's sitting in a chair, and he gives a rather long talk. He talks about this day, and it's a 40-year anniversary. Apparently, it's a very important day for him. It's an important day for President Oaks, because on this day, April 7th, back 40 years ago in 1984, ironically enough, both he and Elder Oaks were called to be apostles. So it's been 40 years, the two of them. And apparently, they're still thick as thieves, because President Nelson has Elder Oaks being his first counselor in the first presidency. He says, we have once again been blessed with an outpouring of the Spirit. Now, I see that. Now, look, this is sort of a pet peeve of mine, because they always say that in conference. We've been blessed with an outpouring of the Spirit, even though nothing's happening except people are being bored to death. They're snoozing. They're leaning over on the shoulder of the person next to them. They're drooling. But no, you will always have them say, we've been blessed with an outpouring of the Spirit. The only thing that underscores this anymore than it already is that he's not even there. He is not talking. This is a pre-recorded message that he recorded before this session. I don't know how long before the session, but before the session. So he's not even present. He doesn't know what's happening at this session. He has no idea whether the Spirit is being poured out. But of course, he's going to say it, because that's what you always say, regardless of where the Spirit is or what it's doing. And yes, he has to talk about the Kirtland Temple. Yeah, we bought it. Last month, we announced that the LDS Church, he says, has purchased the Kirtland Temple, along with other significant sites in Nauvoo. This is the victory lap for President Nelson. This is the spiking the football in the end zone. And he talks about the Kirtland Temple having such great significance to the church because several events happened there. And the most important one happened on April 3rd, 1836. He's going to go to the visitations of Jesus, Moses, Elias, and Elijah. That's what I type out before he goes there, because it's obvious where he's going to go. Now, he is going to talk on and on and on about how essential the priesthood keys are to the functioning of the church today. The priesthood keys that were restored on that date by Moses, Elias and Elijah. Jesus sort of comes to introduce him. He's like the MC of the event. And here's Moses, and Moses gives keys about the gathering of Israel, whatever that means. Elias shows up, who is not, repeat, not the Greek form of the Hebrew Elijah. These are not two different names for the same person. This is a different prophet who we don't read about anywhere in the Bible, but he's real. Trust me. Elias gives keys about the dispensation of Abraham, and then Elijah brings the sealing keys. All right. The thing that is remarkable or noteworthy about the insistence by President Nelson on how important all these keys are to the functioning of the church today and its legitimacy is that there is good reason to question whether this event ever happened at all. And I know that Mormonish did an episode on this with, they had a guest who's a scholar on this who talked, I think, for an hour and a half, I think, a week ago today. And he went into a lot of things. I'm not prepared to go into them now. All I want to say is that there is reason to believe that this entire event about these visitations with the keys was made up sometime after the fact. Of course, there's no fact to make it up after, but after the time when it's alleged to have happened, and written back into the history in some manner. At a minimum, at a bare minimum, we know that Joseph Smith continued after 1836 and really up until his death in 1844, Joseph Smith continued to speak of Elijah as if his coming were still in the future. Joseph Smith apparently never talks about Elijah appearing or any of these other people appearing in his recorded discourses or revelations, although he's moving into discourses more than revelations in Nauvoo. He doesn't refer back to it. He doesn't say this happened. He doesn't talk about it or how wonderful it was. You'd think that'd be remarkable, something you'd want to talk about. Apparently, he doesn't do that. What he does do is he continues to talk about Elijah and how important it is, but he talks about Elijah as if he has not come back yet, and we're still waiting for him to come back, which is a strange thing for Joseph to do if he knows by personal experience, because he was there, that Elijah actually showed up in the Kirtland Temple back in 1836. So it's a bit of a mystery, but it is highlighted by the fact that President Nelson emphasizes that really this church could not exist in the way it does and would not be the Lord's church without the keys. He says the power of these keys is infinite and breathtaking. Without them, you couldn't be endowed. So if that didn't happen back in 1836, we couldn't be endowed. And he says the church could serve only as a significant teaching and humanitarian organization. It would be nice if the church did serve as a significant humanitarian organization. He's acting like it already does. I got a question mark about that. But he says none would have had access. Nobody would have access to the essential ordinances and covenants that bind us together eternally and allow us to live with God, except for those keys that came about from those individuals, angels showing up and giving the keys to Joseph and Oliver in the Kirtland Temple, April 3rd, 1836. He says, priesthood keys are what distinguish this church from any other church upon the earth. No other organization, he says, can and will influence your life after death. But the LDS church, so really all those other churches, they can't do anything about what happens to you after death, but we can't because we have the keys because of that visitation, which may or may not have actually happened. He says, priesthood keys give us the authority to extend all blessings promised to Abraham to every covenant-keeping man and woman. And if we don't have the priesthood keys, then we can't do that. See, the priesthood keys are what make the president of this church the president of this church. He is the only one, we are taught, who has all the keys that are associated with the running of the church and all the ordinances. He's the only one who has them all. If they were never restored, he can't have them. And these keys are so important that if he doesn't have them, he admits, or he, at least he says, that this church just becomes a humanitarian organization, not a church that can control and influence and affect what happens to you and your family in the next life by sealing you in the temple in this life. He says, temple work makes these blessings available to all, regardless of when they lived, and now regardless of where they live. And I think there he's referencing because there's so many that they're closer. He says, the gathering of Israel is evidence God loves all his children everywhere. The blessings of Abraham is evidence that God loves all of his children everywhere. And the sealing power is supernal evidence of how much God loves all of his children everywhere. Those are the three things that were supposed to be restored by Moses, Elias, and Elijah. And that's why he lists them in that order and considers each of those keys, which may or may not have been restored by angels who may or may not have restored them to Joseph and Oliver in 1836, that all of those things are evidence of how much God loves his children. Priesthood keys make it possible for every covenant-keeping man and woman, he says it again, to enjoy incredible personal spiritual privileges. He then goes to Joseph Smith's dedicatory prayer in section 109. He doesn't read from it, but he references it. He calls it a tutorial about how the temple allows us to meet the challenges of life and encourages us to read it on our own. If you take him up on that challenge and do read section 109, please try and ignore the part where God the Father is clearly referred to by the name Jehovah, because that made a lot of sense back then in 1836 when the dedicatory prayer was written by revelation by Joseph Smith, but it doesn't make so much sense today because now Jehovah means Jesus, not the Father. You'll find that Jehovah is applied to the Father in section 109 if you take up President Nelson on his suggestion that you read it. He is really selling temple work with everything he has. He says it will give you strength, glory, power, revelation, the whole shebang. Just go to the temple, go there as often as you can. He says no combination of wickedness will prevail over those who worship in the house of the Lord. And now, He says, I'm going to give you this promise, and I'm ready to go. I've got my fingers poised over the keyboard. This is a very, very long promise, and I think I got most, if not all of it down. So here's his promise from the prophet of God to you. Nothing will help you more to hold fast to the iron rod than worshiping in the temple as regularly as your circumstances permit. Nothing will protect you more as you encounter the world's mists of darkness. Nothing will bolster your testimony of the Lord Jesus Christ and his atonement, or help you understand God's magnificent plan more. Nothing will help soothe your spirits more in times of pain. Nothing will help open the heavens more. Nothing. The temple is the gateway for all the blessings God has in store for each of us. The temple is the only place, this is still President Nelson. The temple is the only place on earth where we can receive the blessings promised to Abraham. That is why we are doing all within our power under the direction of the Lord to make the temple blessings more accessible to members of the church. Okay, that's what I mean when I say he's really pushing the temple attendance now, more than I've ever seen. Well, we've got more temples than I've ever seen, so I guess it makes sense. And of course, now we get to the end of his speech, and he's going to make the announcement of the new temples. There's 15 of them, 15 new temples. And I got them all down, though I'm not sure some of the ones that are in foreign countries, I'm not sure that I got them. I think it's Uteroa in French Polynesia. It's French Polynesia regardless. Chihuahua, Mexico. Someplace in Brazil. Yeah, Brazil doesn't have enough temples. Another place in Argentina. There was Edinburgh, Scotland. There, I think it was Brisbane in Australia. There's Victoria, BC. There's Yuma, Arizona. There's the Houston, Texas South Temple. Houston already has a temple. It's going to get another one. Des Moines, Iowa. That's 10, I believe. Cincinnati, Ohio. Honolulu, Hawaii. And West Jordan. West Jordan is number 13. I thought West Jordan already had a temple. Well, it's going to get another one. Lehigh, Utah. And then a place in Venezuela. It might have been Maracaibo. That's how I heard it anyway. So we're going to have more temples. Can I just please ask the LDS Church for a favor? Could you stop building temples? We have reached the point where it's embarrassing that you keep constructing temples when you don't have the membership to even attend or even staff the temples. The membership is flatlining and going down as far as activity, but your building of temples just continues to go on at an accelerated pace. Would you please, please stop with the temples? Could you put a moratorium on the temple building for a while? More temples are announced, more temples that the world doesn't need, more temples the members don't use, and more temples built with money that could be used to actually help other people. Can we just have a moratorium on the temples, please? That's my request. The choir sings a song, and I can't remember what it was. And then there's a closing prayer. I believe it was a woman. So wonderful. And that is it for the fifth session of General Conference. It's the end of conference. I can't tell you how happy I am. And I'm going to go out now, and I'm going to do something where I don't have to think about General Conference for a good long time. This is the result of General Conference. Is you don't make me want to remember what was said. You make me want to forget it and forget it forever. So thank you so much for joining Radio Free Mormon here with the General Conference postmortem. We have made it. We've made it through together. And thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me. Please hit like. Please hit subscribe. Please go out. If you're watching this live, please go out and do something fun. Do it with friends, do it with family, do it with by yourself, but do something that has nothing to do with General Conference, and I think you'll be happier. That's what I plan to do. Okay, good night, everybody. I'll see you next time on Radio Free Mormon.